Hello, welcome back to a brand new episode of You Please. I'm your host, Abin.
And I'm your co-host, Rohit.
What are we talking about today, my friend?
So, today we're doing something very recent. I don't think it's been a while since we've done a movie that was in contention for Oscars that year, right? Unless,
yes.
And apart from the Oscar lineup movies or whatever. We generally do movies from a few years back or whatever. But today we're going to talk about what is probably the front runner for Best Picture and Best Director and a bunch of other awards. Definitely the most, one of the two most talked about movies of the year.
Yeah.
We're talking about the biopic directed by Christopher Nolan called Oppenheimer.
About the story about J. Bobby Oppenheimer. Nobody ever called him Bobby. It's quite sad.
No.
J. Robert Oppenheimer.
You look at the fedora and the trench coat. It doesn't give off a very Bobby vibe.
He's a Robert. He's like...
Yeah, he's a Robert.
He's not a Bobby guy. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, as Rohit mentioned, this is Oppenheimer, one of two biggest films to have come out of last year, created a whole phenomenon, directed by one of the most talked about directors of the last 20 years or so, Christopher Nolan. Starring everyone and everyone's cat.
Yeah.
this is a movie chock-a-block filled with stars. I was trying to make a list of names to kind of remember for this episode, and I gave up halfway through because there's just way too many. And it was confusing for me putting it down. It'll be even more confusing to our viewers and listeners when if I just randomly start shooting names out there. So just know that this film is populated with a bunch of stars, and if we pull out a star's name randomly halfway through the episode... Just go with it.
Just go with it.
This entire episode's philosophy and that Rohit and I were discussing is about us just going with it. Rohit's a big history nut. So he's about to really unleash some knowledge on you and on me. Mm-hmm. For those of you who are listening to this,
those
he's
are my
now
cringe.
Currently with, yeah, he's currently waving the Manhattan Project book at me. So you know what kind of episode this is going to be.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're gonna do plot summary. We're gonna do themes. We're gonna do impressions. We're gonna do a little fun little bit towards the end, which we've kind of done in the past as well. But that's what the episode is remotely going to be around. So, without any further ado, let's start the show. For your sake and for my sake, the heat is going to kill me in this 1 hour.
It's nuclear.
So let's jump into first impressions, Rohit. What did you think?
Yeah, so I watched this movie, I think, a month ago. Again, one of those movies that I deeply regret not having watched in theaters. To be very honest, my theater going frequency in the last couple of years has taken a massive hit between the startup and having a dog at home and, you know, the associated logistics. Just going to the theater is an exercise in excessive planning, right? So I just and since I now have a projector at home, I'm just like, hey, I can just have my own cinema at home. And yes, it was great to watch it on the projector. I would any day do that over watching it on a TV. Yet while watching it I could, you know, real time sense, damn, if only I had watched this in IMAX, right? Because I like you said I have a very personal fascination with the subject outside of the movie itself, because obviously history, and I waved that book at the start. I've done my fair share of reading about the Manhattan Project. In fact, the book I have is a very fascinating collection of letters, military dispatches, and you know, news articles about the happenings of Los Alamos, or rather the lack of information about the happenings at Los Alamos and the speculations that came up. And it's a very nice angle to look at the Manhattan Project. Anyway, all that to say that, you know, I had that fascination even before the movie came out. So for me, I was fairly familiar with the subject. I was more interested in the treatment of it, especially given the Tenet misadventure that we've spoken enough about. I was like, I really hope Nolan doesn't fuck this up. And boy, did he not. I mean, when I watched it, there are the part that I loved the most, right? There are interludes between scenes of just, I think it's meant to represent close-ups of atomic, like quantum movement, you know, yes. Electrons pinging off. And I mean, oh my God. Like, this is back, you know, this Nolan going back to his roots, back to his auteur roots, and saying, you know what? I am back in complete control of my craft. I am going to take some creative risks purely because I'm Christopher motherfucking Nolan. And I'm going to pull it off, and he fucking does it.
For the large part, I share the same sentiment. So, unlike Rohit, I went and chased this bloody film to for a ticket in IMAX, right? I was looking for it anywhere and everywhere, and it was sold out for weeks. I, funnily enough, wearing the same clothes I currently am, found a ticket for a 12:45 show in the afternoon, a sole ticket in the H row. I have a very specific need when it comes to IMAX films. It's either H to J, or if it's like if it's if let's say the Lincoln Center IMAX is probably B to C because your those rows are a little more higher. But the Bangalore IMAX, primarily, if you want the best viewing experience, H I J is the middle center. This is the centerpiece seats that you get will put you into a really immersive experience. Now, with So I went for this film, and I was a little nervous because every Christopher Nolan movies have been hyped to the point of nausea in the past, and I've been very annoyed with films like Interstellar, films like Dunkirk, films like Tenet more than anything else. So I was very skeptical going into it, and the first half an hour I was kind of like, "Oh, he's doing that thing where his characters just keep jumping and they don't really have emotional depth to them." But then it kind of settled. I think about 35 to 40 minutes into the movie, it settled. And I remember checking my watch for the first time at the 2 hour 10 minute mark, because or just under 2 hours, because that's kind of when the atomic bomb goes off. And I was surprised it had been so long because the film had just kept ticking. And I was like, okay, this is a good film. I really enjoy what it's going. And then it turns into where it's going. And then it turns into The Social Network in the second half of the film. And that was my jam. I absolutely loved the second half of this film. Everyone has complaints about it being too talky. No, this is a great film, especially with how it poses characters, how that whole interrogation sequence happens. Just the frenetic pacing of the second half in a movie that's so talky makes made for such engaging viewing that when I got up, I was like, oh my God, this is probably the first time in a very long time I've enjoyed a Nolan film as much as I did. This is probably one of my favorite, top three favorite Nolan films of all time.
I find it hard to disagree with you. And like you said, it is a very talky film. It's probably the least action-y movie of Nolan's, but as engaging as the best of them.
Ironic, given there's an atomic bomb being detonated halfway through the film.
Fair. But great. I mean, those are our first impressions, but do you want to? I think we've kind of given a plot summary as well, but do you want to just skim over the key events of the film? Because there's a bit of a, you know, time jump, and how do we simplify it for people who haven't watched it?
Okay,
First
so
of all, if
this
you
film
haven't
has.
watched it, guys, there are going to be spoilers on this episode. We're letting you
Yeah,
know
I mean, historical events, spoilers, we need to talk about.
Yeah, fair. I mean, how do you spoil history? Also, that, yeah.
Okay, so let's simplify the film, right? There are two narratives. There's the fission and the fusion. And fission is in color, and it's supposed to be subjective. And it's told from, I think, Oppenheimer's perspective or from Nolan's perspective of what he thought happened and how he interpreted certain things to happen. Fusion is told from the perspective of Robert Downey Jr.'s character, and it's a more objective depiction of what really happened, even though there is a slight tilt there in his favor. So the story tracks Oppenheimer from his days in college to where he's having dreams of electrons bombarding nucleuses or neutrons, basically fission, right? He's imagining or he's dreaming of fission and the impact it's going to have on the world. And sooner rather than later, he gets drafted into the Manhattan Project, or which is, funnily enough, still the original office still exists to this day in a building in 270 Broadway. But anyway, we'll get to that in the trivia section. So he gets drafted, he gets involved in the Manhattan Project. He has ties to a communist to certain Communist Party members. He's in a relationship with Jean Tatlock, who's a known communist. and things don't go well there. He and a lot of the scientists clash on what the right approach is. He has confrontations with Robert Downey Jr.'s Admiral Strauss. He has confrontations with Matt Damon's Leslie Groves, all army members as well. Eventually, the bomb detonates. He's considered a hero, but when the bomb is detonated, he has a moment of conflict, because much like, and this is history, where Oppenheimer famously quotes the Bhagavad Gita and says, "I have now become death, the destroyer of worlds," where he really fears the impact of what his work will have on civilization for the years to come. And because of his ties to the Communist Party in his past, he is put into court hearings where his security clearance is threatened to be revoked. And that basically forms the crux of the film, while Admiral Strauss is fighting for Congress.
Yeah, that's as good a summary as you can give, what with all the time jumps in the film. So that's the movie that we're going to get into the meat and bones of. But before we do that, let's cover BTS. I think this is, for me, the most exciting section of this episode.
Take it away, my friend.
Yes. So let's go all the way back to 1933, right? Let's start with how the whole conception of the atomic bomb came into being, right? So our story now starts with the Hungarian-American scientist Leo Szilard. I think early 1933 was attending a lecture by Rutherford. This was around the time, I think Rutherford had discovered the electron, I think 1 or 2 years prior to that, and he was doing a lecture tour and talking about his discovery and what its implications are on quantum mechanics and, you know, Planck's quantum theory was, I think late 20s is when Planck had come up with it. So, you know, quantum physics was all the vogue at the time. So somebody in the lecture had asked Rutherford, does this have any practical applications in armaments or, you know, weaponry and stuff like that? Are there any applications on that angle? And Rutherford very dismissively said, no, there's nothing. I mean, there's no practical application for this. Yes, we know that electrons can escape the orbit of the of the atom. But I don't see anything worthwhile, you know, to come out of that. And Leo Szilard left the lecture feeling a little peeved, because he thought Rutherford was a little too dismissive in his response. And as the story goes, he was contemplating marinating on the lecture, and he was at a crossing, like a zebra crossing. And he was just half lost in thought, half looking at the lights, which turn, you know, red to green when you got across. And in that red-green, whatever, interplay of the lights, that sparked a thought in him. And he could think of how one electron can then, you know, impact, whatever, it can release neutrons in, two neutrons in another atom. And those two can then release two more in two other atoms. And that's how the concept of chain reaction being something that can be accelerated greatly took shape in Leo Szilard's mind. And I think over the next 3 years, between 33 to 36, he sort of did the math on this to kind of solidify his thesis that, yes, this is something that, if harnessed, can have applications in weaponry, science, energy, all of that, right? And I think towards the fag end of 36, he realized this is something that can be used for good, but something that can very easily run away out of our control and, you know, lead to something catastrophic. So this was around the time when he started reaching out to Einstein, and he said, hey, you're the most famous scientist in the world. People will listen to you when you have to say something. You need to speak to all the, you know, major world leaders that, hey, this is, I mean, today I have thought of it. It is only a matter of time that other scientists and other governments start to come up with the similar conclusions. And we also need to bear in mind, 33 is also the year when the Nazis came to power in Germany. And between 30 to 39, they were solidifying their manifesto, or rather manifesting their manifesto of aggression, of belligerence, of generally being assholes, right? Let's put it that way. So in that context, Szilard kept persisting with Einstein. And there's a very famous letter that Einstein wrote to FDR in 1939, Einstein and a bunch of other scientists, but I mean, his was the header name, right? He was on the marquee. So telling FDR that, hey, you know, this is something that is definitely going to happen. We know for a fact that somebody in Nazi Germany is definitely working on it. And based on, like this, the quantum, the parallel I like to draw is the quantum physicist circle is like the quizzer circle, right?
Hmm.
Beyond a certain point, everyone knows everyone, right?
Yeah.
You know how good somebody is, you know what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are. And that's something that's alluded to in the movie as well. Like, for a fact that Robert Oppenheimer knows that, I don't remember whom he says it to, but he says, if Nazi Germany is working on it, they've got Werner Heisenberg on it, because he's the brightest mind in quantum physics they currently have. Right? So that's the level of detail to which they laid out the possibility of how this would play out to the American government. And yes, FDR bit, but not to the extent that Einstein and co wanted, right? They were like, hey, we need to make the bomb before them, because it's a matter of who reaches the finish line first. Because whoever does, they're going to deploy it ASAP. And if Nazi Germany gets it, it's game over, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you're fighting so hard to stamp out, they're going to have something that we can't beat. It's literally the Ark of the Covenant, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the context. And therefore, eventually, I think closer to 41, between 40 and 41, the movie also alludes to that, is when the government was like, okay, fine, let's get our shit together and put together a project to make this happen, right? And there were, I think, 4 or 5 centers across the US which were going to work together to make this come together, right? There were a couple of universities in California. I think San Diego was one. And there's one more. I'm forgetting all of the locations per se, where the fissile material, which is uranium-235, was going to be created, accumulated. Yeah. And even getting U-235 from the more naturally occurring U-238 isotope, sorry to get a little scientific here, guys, but is a very painstaking, expensive, energy-consuming, time-consuming process, right? So, I mean, more than anything else, that was the bottleneck for why the atomic bomb could not get could not be ready sooner, right? So there were 2 centers dedicated to that. There were a couple of centers that were dedicated to just making, you know, the bomb component. And because you're housing a material or a payload which is completely different from anything else you've delivered so far, even the bomb construction had to be a little more specific, a little different. So there were a team doing that. And Los Alamos was where all of it was, all of the scientific minds were doing the theory and, you know, all of it, bringing it all together, right? And Oppenheimer was picked to lead that. And so that's the context. I mean, in and of itself, even if you put aside the movie, any book you read about the Manhattan Project, any book you read about Oppenheimer or any of the people involved in it, right? Even if you look at the kind of scientists that were involved in the Manhattan Project, it's very similar to the cast of Oppenheimer, right? It's literally the who's who. You have one Neumann, who was probably the smartest man who ever lived. You had Feynman over there. You had Oppenheimer.
Which was for me a big surprise. Like, I had never realized. I thought Feynman was a little younger, or rather he was
in his early 20s. So this is, I mean, he started off at his peak, right? Like in the early 20s, he found the Manhattan Project. Like, where do you go from there? There was him, there was Edward Teller, there was, who also plays a pivotal role in the movie. There was Einstein, who wasn't actively involved, but he was consulting with them. I mean, the list goes on, right? Literally the who's who. Niels Bohr was a consultant. For my project as well, not as actively involved, but again, in the movie as it's shown, he drifts in and out of the narrative. It had 2 camps, more or less, right? There was Heisenberg and co. with Wernher von Braun working on how you deliver the payload. Wernher von Braun, who was without a doubt probably the best rocket scientist of his time and of the last century, right? So much so that after the war got over, the US smuggled him out and you know, made sure he didn't get executed with the rest, because they wanted to use his knowledge. So, Wernher von Braun and Heisenberg and co. on one side, and you have, like, you know, the Ocean's 12 of, or Ocean's 13 of quantum science physicists on the other side working in the US. So, like I said, keeping the movie aside, in and of itself, this is a absolutely fascinating story, right? The fact that this happened in our past less than 100 years ago, just this agglomeration of genius to collectively solve a problem because for all intents and purposes, humanity was at stake. Like the stakes don't get higher than that, right? It is a narrative that lends itself to storytelling, to filmmaking so completely and so compulsively. I mean, to me, it's a surprise that it took till 2023 for someone to make something like an Oppenheimer, right? I would have made the movie like immediately after World War II. Super exciting. So, I mean, all of this excitement for me went into watching the film. And I hope this short history come science lesson gives you all greater appreciation for what this movie is trying to talk about, right? Yes, it is about Oppenheimer, but it is as much, if not more so, about the Manhattan Project and the struggle of all these brilliant minds to solve this very important problem.
I think what really adds a nice twist to the entire situation is not just are they in an arms race, because kind of they're in a bit of an arms race when it comes to who will be the first person to develop that bomb. But also, this has never been tested before, and there is a slight possibility that when the bomb detonates, it ignites the atmosphere, and that could signal the end of the world. So that's a risk as a scientist that you don't know like what is going to happen, because it's never been done before. And if you don't do it, the chances are somebody else more braver or more desperate would jump at the opportunity to take that chance. So it's a nice juxtaposition of both internal conflict and the need to get one up your enemy at a time where the world was in such a mess, right?
Yeah. I know I've gone on a history tangent here, but the other BTS story or whatever, like memory I have of hearing stories about Oppenheimer was, in hindsight, it's obvious that this was a prank, but given Nolan's history of being very realistic with his stunts and, you know, doing what needs must to be as authentic on screen as possible. I don't know if you recall, there were these stories that Nolan had detonated a natural nuke, right? For the scene where the whole atomic explosion happened. And I remember reading it, I was like, no way, but. No way, but. Yeah. It's not outside the realm of
possibility,
but I mean it can't be, right? I that was a whole hilarious episode, I remember. But apart from that, anything else you want to add?
Well, you know, let's delve deeper into that. What, so he didn't detonate a nuke, it he was did, just yeah. he didn't, yeah.
That would be insane, man.
Or did he? He's like, I imagine him pitching it to Hoyt Van Hoytema being, dude, you get this shot, it's going to be worth the cancer you're going to get in the next 10 years. Hoyt Van Hoytema with this.
This film is too die for.
This too die. But they did. And as far as I know, there was a live detonation. I don't know if it's nuclear or not. But
Some 10 kiloton explosion is what I read about. It wasn't nuclear. Mm.
They spruced it up with a little bit of VFX and so on and so forth.
Yeah. But you said you had some trivia about Oppenheimer's office and stuff. I'm curious to hear that.
Yeah. So the Manhattan Project was, like, funnily enough, like, why is it called the Manhattan Project? Because the original plan was to set up an office in Manhattan.
I never thought about that.
Yeah, and they did set it up in Manhattan at 270 Broadway. And then they moved it to Los Alamos, where they conducted testing and created a whole neighborhood for the scientists there, right? So the funny thing is, at 270 Broadway is now apartments. Like, the whole thing is just apartments. Everything, barring the 18th floor, is just floors of apartments. The 18th floor has been left relatively untouched as a historical artifact, or like a place of historical prominence. So if you were to visit the 18th floor of the of 270 Broadway, you will notice that not much has changed. It's just been kept the way it is.
Interesting. This is, I've only been to New York once for a day and a half back when I was a kid. So we did the usual stupid sites or whatever. But if I ever go, this is one of the places I definitely want to visit.
Broadway and Broadway Lafayette are great spots if you're like, obviously, if you're a history nut, and then if you want to see where David Bowie stayed. There are a bunch of really interesting things. Like, we were walking past the Dakota, and it's, I don't think it's no longer called the Dakota. It's called the Dakota, but it's not advertised. So we were walking past, and my friends were like, "Oh, this is the apartment from Only Murders in the Building." I was like, "No, I'm pretty sure this is, like, I've seen this building before, and just the first time I've seen it." I was like, "Oh, this is the Dakota, Central Park. John Lennon was shot here, like right here." And so it's those historical moments where you're just like, fuck, man, okay, it's a moment in time happened here, and I'm just like eating a burger on the sidewalk.
Yeah, shit. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was our BTS section, unless you want to talk about how, I don't know, if you want to spend a hot minute on how everyone and their uncle was in this film. That's another thing I remember. There used to be a Reddit post literally every other day in r/movies saying, this person has been announced as part of Oppenheimer. That person has been announced as part of Oppenheimer. I was like, there's going to be a time when, like, Rohit Rao has been announced as part of Oppenheimer. Robin Shetty has been announced as part of Oppenheimer.
You know, I wasn't really, like, what do you call, taken aback by any of the casting announcements until one piece of news broke out, and it was Josh Peck being cast in this. And I was what? I was like, yeah, Josh Peck and Oppenheimer. I'm like, I'm really, like, I'm a big Josh Peck fan. Grew up with the guy, Drake and Josh, big part of my childhood. And I'm not unsure of the scientist he plays, but he's the guy who detonates who presses the button. He's in it. He's barely in it. Like, there are Oscar winners here who are here for Blink and Miss roles. Like, Rami Malek as David Hill, I think, the scientist.
Yes. Why would he take that role up?
It is, if you look around, like, Jack Quaid is Richard Feynman. He's there for, again, a Blink and Miss role.
Yeah, literally.
Who else was there? And I completely missed him the first
Gary
time.
Gary Oldman as Truman. Yeah,
Gary Oldman
scene,
is Truman.
One scene.
But then again, if you've seen Killers of the Flower Moon, Brendan Fraser has a similar situation. Brendan Fraser shows up in the film at 3-hour, 5-minute mark. Like, he's nowhere in the film. And Jesse Plemons shows up about 2.5 hours into the film. So I guess that's the new norm these days. You get really big name actors and they pop up much later into the film. Jason Clarke as, what's the lawyer's name?
Cobb. Some
Roger Robb. Yeah.
Roger Robb.
Cobb is he's from Inception.
Oh, yeah. Shit.
Roger Robb, he plays this particularly nasty character. Robert Downey Jr. is probably the star of this film. Cillian Murphy's name is titled, his character, the title of the film, but Robert Downey Jr. kind of steals this. He's so good as Admiral Stross.
He's really good. I loved him. I'm saying, why are you discounting Cillian Murphy?
Oh, I'm not. I'm saying Cillian Murphy is very good in his own way, but I'm also accounting for the fact that RDJ kind of, like, I hadn't seen this in...
Yeah, I mean, if you had to say one Oscar, it's probably RDJ's. The movie had to win one Oscar, yes. But,
Killian Murphy.
Everyone, so even Matt Damon. Yeah. Matt Damon. I'm being very nitpicky here. The only complaint I would have of Matt Damon is his portrayal of Leslie Groves wasn't abrasive enough. Because whatever I've read of Leslie Groves, that man brooked zero bullshit, right? Like, he took shit from nobody. And he was very brusque, very, like, hey, I am in charge here. I don't give a damn what you feel, what you think. If I'm telling you this happens, this is what is going to happen. They toned it down a little bit, probably to make the character more palatable, because at the end of the day, he's one of the good guys. That's my only, like, I'm putting on my history nerd glasses and being nitpicky, that's it.
I think, have you reached a point with Matt Damon where you look at him in a film and you just see Matt Damon? Like, I was looking at Leslie Groves and he was like, I was like, oh, okay. That's Leslie Groves, but that's actually Matt Damon.
Yeah.
Like, he's too big a star. He's too big a name at this point.
Too recognizable a face. I agree. But again, I mean, that does not, we're not detracting from his performance. It's just, he has the unfortunate circumstance of being Matt Damon.
Yeah.
But cool. I think let's move on to memorable moments. Which were the moments in the movie which you recall the most?
Okay, the first being, okay, I'm going to like talk about, not even the obvious, I want to talk about a funny situation that is exclusive only to Indian audiences. So I watched this movie in theater first, and I watched most of it in preparation for this episode, right? So the whole sequence, his relationship with Jean Tatlock, Florence Pugh's character, and what happens at the early start. So this is probably the first film where Nolan has been very open with nudity. I don't recall a film where I think Memento might have had a little bit, but I don't recall other Nolan films where he showcases sex the way he does in this. And so watching this in Indian audiences, because of the censor board, and they couldn't really trim the scene, they kind of have given Florence Pugh this black dress that covers her and her body up to her like neck. And it's meant to be some sort of a censor while they're sitting in the chair and having a conversation, or while she's sitting on top of him and asking him to read the Bhagavad Gita. It was a very, very strange scene. Like, I was like, I'm surprised this film didn't get as much blowback as I thought it would have with regards to how the current climate is around topics such as those, right? But anyway, I'm glad it didn't. But it's, again, a weird scene. And then you have this weird, like, censored dress that's going up and down. And it was very, it took me out of the experience. And then I watched it again recently and I was like, oh, okay. This is a very different viewing experience compared to what I saw in theaters. So that it's not a memorable moment because the moment is like good or like something. It's funny because of the context in which I watched it.
No, but I mean, I was going to bring that up, bring that scene up anyways. And I watched it home uncensored or whatever. I didn't feel offended. I don't think there's any need to take offense. It is creative expression at the end of the day. I mean, if you want to, yes, it is a religious text that is being used in a very unreligious context in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever, right? I don't care of that. I don't care about that point. But the artistic expression itself is a little weird. I'm like, the scene is not gelling for me. Why would anyone want to be here? Why anyone want to hear the Bhagavad Gita recited to them when that person is balls deep in you, right? It's just.
I think that's the Indian. That's the Indian in you, because I think for us we have the cultural context for it, so it will make it extremely awkward. I think if
any person situation, I have a very weird. So when that whole thing was going on, I had like this childhood memory trigger where you've grown up watching the Mahabharata, right?
Of course, yeah.
Like you have the whole Krishna Arjuna scene apart. You remember Ramanand Sagan's Mahabharata used to start with the whole chant yada yada hi dharmasya. I watched it every Sunday. The chant is etched into memory. And for some reason, while watching the scene, suddenly that whole Mahabharata intro came into my mind. I'm seeing Krishna, I'm seeing Arjuna on the battlefield. And I'm like, that whole discordant, whatever, the clash I had in my mind, I'm like, I am so confused. And like, right now, what is happening?
It's the sanitized Mahabharata that we've all grown up with is one that will forever be etched in our brains, and it pops up at the wrong occasions, clearly, like as this one. It's my slightest triggers. But yeah, let's move past this side. The more I think about it, the more weird I feel. Okay, what do you have?
I mean, the obvious one is the atomic explosion scene. Getting into the movie, that was the thought top of my mind, right? Like, how is he going to tackle this scene? I'm super curious about it. Chef's kiss, dude. The whole 2 minute build up to it, again he reverts back to that Dunkirkish style of using the ticking of the clock to, you know, showcase time passing, and typical Nolan, you know, 4 or 5 points of view about the event. It just jumps back and forth, the music crescendos, and you're like, by the time the bomb actually explodes, like, you are ready to explode, right? All of that pent up excitement. And it's filmed beautifully, right? If not the whole movie, that scene alone really took me down this whole rabbit hole of seeing YouTube videos of other famous explosions. I mean, most atomic tests have been filmed, right? From planes, by whatever, high altitude planes. So I was looking at the explosion of Tsar Bomba, Bravo, all of the very biggest ones, just to see how accurate it was, like how much he got it right. And the cinematic representation filled me with as much awe and horror as the real life tests are. So I think he got it spot on, knocked it out of the park with that scene.
And the explosion followed by the sound.
Yes.
Which is again, not a lot of films do, where funnily enough, you hear the Bhagavad Gita line there as well.
Yes.
From the same context, I like how are two our two memorable moments have fused into each other. And again, then the sound follows the explosion and how the ripple effect has on different perspectives, right? Because people are placed at different vantage points. Some people are close to the bomb, they get the full blast of it. Some people are further away, they get like a rumble. And the third people just get, and the third group, which I think is Edward Teller and Feynman's group, get like a light
that breeze. That is the most bizarre thing, right? You are like sitting in Sundex and you're putting glasses and you're watching like, motherfucker, it's a nuclear explosion. What are you doing? How are you so remarkably blasé about it? You don't know what the radius of radioactivity is. What are you doing?
Did they all die? I knew Feynman died. Yeah, Feynman died from cancer in the late 80s. Oppenheimer 60.
Well, late 80s, you're fine. I'm just saying, I'm glad it didn't go really bad for any of them, but it so easily could have, right? Like,
yes.
Who does these things?
What are some of the other memorable moments? Okay, I forgot completely mentioned Josh Hartnett looking like Val Kilmer. him popping up in this film, and I was like, Josh Hartnett, what happened to you? Like, he got buff. And I was just thinking, my God, Batman.
Part buff, I would say. A little flabby also, but I mean, I don't want to fat shame or anything. He's not entirely buff, whatever. He's been in the wilderness for a bit and he's come back.
Yeah. Josh Hartnett has Dr. Lawrence. We'll get to him later. Another memorable moment right at the start of the film is when I think Patrick Blackett, where he's training theoretical physics under Patrick Blackett, and he gets pissed off with him, and so he injects his apple with with cyanide?
Fuck, yeah, cyanide. What a psychotic guy! Imagine, dude, you get pissed off with your prof, you poison him. What is wrong with you?
I don't know what it is was about that apple. I was like, okay, fine. There is this weird correlation between him and another scientist, but I'll get to that in the theme side of it. If you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. So that was something that stuck out to me.
I also love the whole scene in his dorm room when he looks out and he starts imagining those nuclear reactions in his head. I think I'm just a sucker for whenever anyone's beautiful minding it, right?
Yeah.
Any beautiful minding in the vicinity, I'm just like, I love this.
I'm in for this situation.
Yeah. The other scene I want to talk about is when he's back in college, or there's a bunch of students that he's addressing after the explosion. And while he's talking to them, there's this whole parallel where he imagines them burning up. And, you know, there's an explosion.
Oh, that's in Los Alamos. That's in the gym in Los Alamos people are celebrating.
Yeah, and there's a discordant sound. I'm like, all of the elements of cinema, sound, visual, like acting, all of it comes together so well in that scene.
That scene, I think, is supposed to signify his anxiety. So every time he gets anxious and he gets in his head, you hear stomping. And it kind of builds up throughout the film. And it builds up to that scene where the bomb goes off and they've detonated it in Hiroshima. And then you start to see, like, he starts visioning people's faces peeling off, like walking over corpses. And, like, he's really coming to terms with the gravity of what he's done. But before even that happens, there's where they're deciding where to bomb, like what city to bomb in Japan. I think they're having a discussion with James Remar's character. I forgot who he plays. I put it up on the screen. And he says, okay, we have a list of 11 cities, but no, we have what, 10 cities. And he takes Kyoto off the list because he says Kyoto is
culturally
significant, and it's where I went on my honeymoon. So
what a reason, right?
And yeah, and I think the Tokyo firestorm, no, was that what it was, or where was the
firebombing of Tokyo? It was a firebombing of Tokyo, which happened like a few months, I think towards the end of 1944 or early 1945, which is itself was a humanitarian disaster, right? Firebombing took place. What happened that night was it was a very windy night. So the winds carried the fires and kept them going far longer than they should have. I think 100,000 people died in one night in Tokyo.
Yeah. Like a huge death toll. Yeah. Very, again, this is, I feel like, coming up where we're reaching cultural zeitgeist moments of mentioning. If you want to see a depiction of what this looked like, you can watch Grave of the Fireflies.
Oh my god.
Which, yeah, you know, which opens with the firebombing of Tokyo, and it's a horrid depiction of it. Really brutal. And for some people who are complaining about the Japanese side of the story not being shown, there are other films that you can go check out. And
depict what Hiroshima. A double feature, Oppenheimer and Grave of the Fireflies. Depressed at the end of it.
You know what the double feature actually should be?
What?
You do a back-to-back, a double feature of Oppenheimer and Godzilla Minus One. Because Godzilla Minus One is a period piece. It's about a kamikaze pilot who was a failed kamikaze pilot. So he's living with the guilt. And Japan have just put themselves back to zero after what happened in the World War. And then Godzilla pops up.
Yeah,
I think it's important to address the cultural relevance of Godzilla, given, I mean, I know this is a weird film. This is a movie about a man who invented the atomic bomb. But the impact it had on the Japanese, on Japanese lives, and
for those who don't know, like, Godzilla is a very, very clear, it has very obvious allusions to nuclear fallout, right?
Yeah.
One obviously is the mutation of animals, mutation of a lizard because of nuclear fallout or nuclear radiation is what leads to Godzilla. The other way, they've alluded to it, at least in the 1954 Ishiro Honda original, the scars, the skin of Godzilla, the whole rough texture is an allusion to the scars that people who were affected by the bombing had on their skin, right? Those who weren't literally obliterated by it, with the burns that they had, the third degree burns, look like, I mean, that formed the basis or inspired the look of Godzilla in the Ishiro Honda original. So very, very close ties to nuclear fallout, that movie has.
Yeah. Okay, what else do you have?
I think that covers most of my memorable moments. Let's dive into the themes. What's the first theme that you want to discuss?
I think one being the direct correlation of useful till you're not. This is, so, I mean, there's a film that came out in 2015, 2016 called The Imitation Game. About Alan Turing and his the Enigma machine, right?
Yeah.
And about how this brilliant maths genius was brought in to help win the war, not to a degree where, you know, and not cause the level of devastation Oppenheimer did, but a significant impact with regards to the war. And then after the war was over, he was, because of his past and because of the person he was subjected to utter cruel treatment from the government, who kind of shut him out and then ultimately forced him down a very dark path, which led him to taking his life. Similarly with this, not that Oppenheimer took his own life, but with regards to what happened post-detonation, his ties to his communist past, his brother's ties to his communist past. I think his brother got the shorthand of the stick of the straw, because he got sent to work in like a mine or something because of his communist ties. The Red Scare happened not too long after this, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. McCarthyism was the 50s.
McCarthyism and the Red Scare is the same thing, right? If I'm not mistaken.
More or less.
Or is it more or less? Just this fear of communists that the Soviets were coming to take over American soil. And they'd been allies through World War II, so it was a bit strange there. But anyway, it was a time where fear was being stoked and Oppenheimer was used as a whipping boy to showcase that nobody is above the American law.
Yeah.
And it's just what he had to go through, what stuff he and his wife had to go through. I'm not saying he was a saint, and one could argue that he could have fought harder to prevent the detonation of the bomb. But generally, with the people, with how Edward Teller kind of didn't come to his aid, with a lot of scientists refusing to back up his point, and with the Strauss character using him, bringing up an old grudge to beat him on the head with, it was quite disappointing, and it's a story that's not very new, clearly.
Yeah, true. I think it's. I mean, are you trying to say homosexuality and communism are?
No, far from it. What I'm just going to say is that I'm not far from it. But
I get what you're saying, right? In the exhilaration of the moment, or in the fervor of trying to achieve a common goal, People conveniently put aside the more troubling aspects of one's personality. Again, troubling from their perspective. I'm not saying his sympathies or Turing's orientation were troubling. But it's so cynical the way people can choose to discard their worry about these aspects of you when you when they need you to do something. But the moment that is done, you know, they're like, hey, yeah, good job, but now let's talk about this, right? This is why you are problematic, and now we're going to discard you, we're going to throw you. So it's very infuriating, it's very cynical, it's very disheartening. I mean, these are the two most prominent examples. If we dig deeper, I'm sure there are innumerable such examples of, you know, great minds having been put to the side for things that, at least in today's day and age, don't matter as much to us, right? So
there's also the opposite could be said, no, when in situations where like war criminals have been offered because of the
and the opposite, exactly, right? Werner von Braun in the same sphere of war is an, a prime example. Dude made V2 rockets which helped Germany like unfold untold chaos on the continent, right? And right after the war, they were like, yeah, you can hang the rest. That guy we want. The US, you know, like sort of scooped him out of Germany and got him here. He was a big part of the first set of, not the moon landing per se, but the first set of earlier missions, early 60s, the first mission in space for the Americans and stuff, was sort of heralded or spearheaded by von Braun. So, yeah, it's very cynical how geopolitics work. Geopolitics, you can call it, or whatever, right? Like, people's, what's the word I'm looking for? Affiliations or their loyalties are so fickle. While we all know it to be true, it just is sad to see it play out in the case. When it happens to like really bright minds, it's just all that sadder.
It's this, I forget what the, even in Japan's case, no, what is, I mean, going back to
Unit 731, the
731 or 731, right? Yeah. 731. Oh man. And the guy who headed it, I forgot his name,
but he did a lot of biological experiments of prisoners on prisoners of war. So again, after the war, they spirited him. He was spirited away.
Shiro Ishii is the guy. Yeah, yeah.
He was spirited away. And I don't know whose neighbor he was, but okay, lower doing it. So he was spirited away, and the US used his learnings for making biological weapons and stuff. And it's like, it's so convenient, right? All of this is so transitory and so transactional. It's sad. But
if you haven't read about Unit 731, I highly, you should, I'm going to talk about
If you haven't read about Unit 731, you're really fortunate. Just move on with your life.
Yeah, some of the things, oh my God, with regards to them testing human limits, oh wow, it's just, it's insane.
Just don't read about it. It's nice. You have a very nice, secluded life. Be happy. Yeah. Don't read about it.
We're going to get flagged. Someone's going to read it because we told them not to, and now they're going to yell at us. Hey,
yeah. But okay. We're not joking. If you haven't, please don't. But the other theme I want to talk about is the flip side of brilliance. It's sort of related to the first theme that you brought up, which is that, and again, time and again, this has happened, right? A very direct parallel to this is the discovery of Greek fire, which ironically, I don't think took place in Greece. This was somewhere in Persia in like 330s BC. I might be wrong here, but Greek fire was one of those things when, at the time, it was a quantum leap in weaponry, right? A fire that you could not extinguish in the traditional means. When it was created, everyone was like, wow, wow, this is amazing. And then immediately after it was created, the narrative was, shit, what have we done, right?
Yeah.
What had God wrought kind of narrative. Similar thing here, while they were in the throes of the arms race with Nazi Germany, they were like, yeah, this is the coolest idea ever. We need, like, there's nothing wrong with what we're doing, right? Let's get rushed to the finish line. But as you get closer, again, there is a very lovely dichotomy here, which the film also explores, which is that the scientific mind is always contemplating the larger picture, right? Yes, war will be there today. It will not be there tomorrow. But what we're trying to, the barrier we are breaking here, is going to have ramifications far beyond this war, far beyond this century, far beyond this millennium even, right? So what about that question? Well, the military is very myopic. It's focused on solving the problem at hand. We're like, this is a weapon. This weapon will end the war. That's all we care about, right? So the dichotomy between the scientific and the military mind plays out perfectly here. You see Oppenheimer having doubts as to what are we doing here, right? Closer to the atomic testing, and obviously that ramps up once the actual bombings take place in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And you see the scientific community start talking, yeah, cool, war's done, great, congrats, we won. What now, right? Because we've opened a door that cannot be closed.
Be closed, yeah.
Yeah, so there's this, which is the flip side of genius. Sometimes you solve problems in the pure scientific spirit of, hey, this is a lovely, great, interesting problem to solve. But then you solve the problem, you're like, should we have solved
Yeah.
this? Right?
It's like, what is
Another
the
example, are we
hold on.
playing God? Right? Like another example that comes to mind is the whole CRISPR technology, which is where you can now modify genes, right? You can sort of pick and choose what attributes, what genes that give you certain attributes can be switched on or switched off, right? At this point, you are literally, I mean, when I say playing God, I'm not talking about it in the theosophical sense, but you are determining what otherwise happens naturally, right? You are controlling very strong natural forces. Should you do that? The problem is nobody takes time to answer these questions of should you, which is the whole Jurassic Park thing, right? You were so caught up in whether we could, you never stopped to ask whether we should, right?
We should.
So it
Similarly,
never
I
happened.
mean,
Never happened.
yeah, in a much lighter, not lighter, I'd say, but I'd say not with regards to playing God, but we're recording this the week Sora, which is Gen
Yeah.
AI's video platform, was launched, and it looked beautiful. But also the thing, the moment people saw it, they said, okay, this is what it is. Lock it up and never put it and never show it to anyone again, because it has the potential to spread misinformation like no one else. It has
Genie's
the
out of the
potential.
bottle.
Yeah,
Deepfakes are
Jenny's
now
out.
it's done.
With what happened to Taylor Swift a few weeks ago, with regards to someone spreading deep fakes of her on the internet, it's forget about just people in general, because the revenge side of things was it's a very slippery slope to you don't know what's going to happen there. And it's the amount of misinformation that people will start to spread, governments will start to use. It's there. It is like the ink is out the bottle, like the genie's out of the bottle. Like, this is spilt ink. You don't know what to do now.
Yeah.
You can't put it back into the bottle right now. So it's even with the way AI is evolving, and with the need to, like, is it moral to put ethical constructs around it, or is it should you just let things? Should you stop trying to control the narrative and let people make their own choices? There is this weird conundrum that people find themselves in at the moment.
Yeah, and again, I fear that we will. By the time we stop to consider it, it is going to be too late. I think it already is too late,
I think it's way too late. I think this is our reality now. Like, I think, given what happened after what I saw, I just said, oh wow, we're screwed. We're like, the world will never be the same again.
So there's that. The other, I think the last of the themes that I had in mind, I mean, if you have any, feel free to add. But the other theme I wanted to quickly spend a couple of minutes on is the power of pettiness, right? Which, like you said, the other half of the narrative which we haven't addressed as much is Strauss, played by Robert Downey Jr., his almost crusade to bring down Oppenheimer, right? Because of a perceived slight, it's not even it's Strauss's point of view of events, where there's this meeting that he sets up between Oppenheimer and Einstein, where Strauss feels that Oppenheimer had made a derisive remark about him. And when they were laughing or something, Strauss thought that they were laughing about him. When in fact, there's a lovely scene where Alden Ehrenreich, I don't know how to
Oh, I
pronounce
forgot he's in this movie too. Yes.
it. Yes. His character says, do you think they were talking about something more important than you? I mean, that's as good a slap in Strauss's face, right? Like, do you think you're significant enough for these titanic minds to spend their times talking about your insignificant life? I'm not getting the word, but the sheer gall to think, you are important enough for Audacity. The topic of Audacity is the word I was looking for. It's just, yes, it's funny. It's fascinating, right? That a person looks at himself in such a way. Strauss obviously has a very high opinion of himself. And he's not used to being talked down to the way Oppenheimer does to him, right? And Oppenheimer, for those of you who don't know, comes from wealth. Like, he was born into money. And he has that easy elegance about him. And easy condescension also. Oppenheimer did tend to be a slightly condescending person. So, all of that grates against Strauss. And, you know, this sort of reminder, the other parallel that came to mind was, I was reading about how there are these whole recorded tapes of Nixon and Henry Kissinger conversations in the White House. First of all, these two morons recorded all of their conversation for all of, you know, posterity to look back and laugh at how stupid and wrong and bigoted and assholey they were, where they've spoken about how the blacks and the Jews, they've spoken very badly about them. They even spent a lot of time talking about how they said Indians are the ugliest looking people. They whatever, they look weird. Mm-hmm. They have nothing interesting about them. And Nixon talks about Indira Gandhi with such vitriol. He's like, she's the ugliest woman I've seen. She's not attractive at all. This, that.
First time, pot calling kettle black. Black.
Yes. First time, I'm like, have you looked into a mirror, Richard Nixon? You like, you are in the annals of ugliest people in history. Like, fucking look at that nose. But anyway, that apart, she's a politician. She's not a Playboy model. Why are you rating her on attractiveness? Right? If she's effective at her job, that's all she needs to be. Then I was like, why? Like, I can attribute it to assholeness. Fine. Nixon is an asshole is a good punchline, whatever, is a good explanation for anything. But there must have been a reason for it. So, very similar story, right? So, this was, I think, late 60s when Nixon was an envoy or some senator or something before he was president. He had come down to India for a tour and he had gone to seek an audience. That sounds very royal. He had gone to meet Indira Gandhi and she acquiesced, saying, sure, I'll spend whatever, half an hour with him, just chit-chat, blah, 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 etc. And he was very enthusiastic. He was talking to her about this, that, and apparently, she seemed very bored, right? And I mean, she didn't make it very apparent. But then at one point, she turned to her attendant or whatever and said, "Kitna time baki hai?" Like, how much longer do I have to suffer this fool, right? Although she said it in Hindi, the vibe was enough for him to get pissed off.
Catch on.
Apparently, he remembered this and like stored it, filed it away in his memory for the rest of his life. And he just hated it. Like, bro, and you guys elected this jackass president. I mean, Nixon famously is such a petty, small man, right? And him and Kissinger got to dictate so much of world policy, and so many people in Southeast Asia died because of that bullshit in the Vietnam War. And it's just fucking tragic, right? Like, the policies he pursued because of the kind of person he was, you can't let your ugliness spread to the extent he did.
What, he came into power, what, late 70s, early 80s, Richard Nixon?
68, I think, 68, 69. Because his term would have ended in 72, 71, 72 is when he resigned.
Who was in the early
80s? Immediately after LBJ. After LBJ was Nixon.
Lyndon B. Johnson, then Nixon. And then, was it?
Gerald Ford.
Jimmy Carter? Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford and then Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter, okay. Okay, I wanted to see, like, if this was this a time they elected him during, was the Cold War was the 80s or was it the 70s? I'm not
remembering. Cold War was off 50s to 90s.
50s to 90s. So it went, so they elected him at a time when the Cold War, when Soviet fear was higher, right? And he was, so it seemed like they were just...
Thankfully, the Vietnam War had wound down or was winding down. Otherwise, he would have probably done a lot more untold damage. But just generally an unpleasant personality, right?
Not the best.
Let's that should be on the gravestone.
It's all about not the best. Even the Truman moment in this film is such a dicky move. He's like, he actually said it also. He said, "Don't let that crybaby scientist back here again."
Yes, it is a rough moment. I don't know if it is. I understand Oppenheimer's concern, but what Truman said was not wrong, right? It's if you think it's on your conscience, I had to make the call for them to drop those two bombs, right? Don't fucking come to me and tell me you're feeling bad. It's like, again, you're preaching to the fucking choir here, right? As president, I have to take tough calls 10x of what you do. So don't come wasting my time saying, oh, you're having an emotional tantrum. Deal with it yourself. So harsh but fair is what I would classify it as.
Fair enough. But yeah, I think that should cover the two themes. Obviously, there's the Prometheus, the biggest parallel being Prometheus gives fire to the people, is chained to a rock and to have his intestines eaten by an eagle day in and day out.
Yeah.
So that played a huge part. The second half of this film is what really I'm such a big fan of. The core drama, just how things escalate. How Jason Clarke, Emily Blunt, Alden Ehrenreich, and Robert Downey Jr., they basically carried this film in the second half. Of course, Cillian Murphy is the unspoken, goes without saying, really. I was thoroughly invested through this part of the film. And yeah, I think I'll keep going back to it. I was rewatching recently, and there's some of the earlier parts of the film I still have a bit of issue with. I'm like, okay, you're kind of like trying to sort out your characters at the early part of the film, but man, such engaging viewing.
Yeah, I really hope it gets him his long overdue Oscar. Yeah, the movie deserves all the plaudits it wins.
Who stars in the Indian remake?
Oh damn, this is gonna be a long list. Okay, who stars in the Indian remake? You want me to give a serious answer or like? What the fuck?
No. Who do you think? See, the movie is greenlit. No, of course not. Just think about it. This is a movie about history. It's about one man. And think about how it will be skewed to make him the hero.
No, whoever really want to be as the same? Abhay Deol.
You know who will get cast?
Don't tell me Ranveer Singh or some shit.
No, far from it.
No.
Oh. it'll be Oppenheimer starring Akshay Kumar.
Yeah, maybe some jingoistic nationalist piece.
Of course.
No, but actually, the parallel I could think of was Abhay Deol as Oppenheimer, right? He's mercurial enough. He's got that intensity that kind of role deserves. The rest of the cast is too long for us to do this exercise.
Yeah, dude, this is yeah. But anyway, if you haven't seen Oppenheimer, I mean, wow, okay. I know a lot of people haven't liked it. A lot of people felt it was very talky. It is very long. It is 3 hours.
It's not a typical Nolan film. So people who went in expecting wow are not going to get that.
Yeah, shout out to Ludwig Göransson, man. What a bloody score.
Oh, man. Amazing. But it's not that kind of movie, but it is an... If you like good storytelling and if you like the subject matter, it's like history in any sense, this is the movie for you.
Go check it out. It's streaming. And also, if you have the opportunity, watch this on 4K. I am watching this movie on 4K. It is gorgeous. Like the changing aspect ratio has pissed me off a little bit. But in terms of the quality of the image, oof. It's like I could bite into the screen. It's that good.
I had to take the Jack Sparrow route, but the file I got was 4K. It was insane viewing.
So good. Anyway, I think that's us. Anything more to add?
Nope. I think I'm all out of all of the stuff that I had to get out of me.
Okay, beautiful. This is perfectly timed because I'm about to just start melting into a puddle. It is that hot in this room.
Yeah, it is. I can see.
Okay. Wow, thanks. Anyway. That's us for this week's episode. We'll see you on the next one. I am going to go shower again. Take care. See you soon.
Bye-bye.